Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. As Governor Sam Brownback prepares to leave office, many Kansans, both Republican and Democrat, believe Brownback is leaving the state in worse shape than when he first arrived. Our guest, Paul Johnson, organic farmer and longtime lobbyist for the Kansas Rural Center, is no exception to this sentiment. And in tonight's talk, Johnson will share his unique perspective on Brownback's controversial 8 years as governor of Kansas. Earlier this week, Governor Brownback gave his final State of the State address, and in many ways, in this presentation, Johnson gives an alternative State of the State address. Johnson's talk is wide-ranging and cogent, with emphasis on public education, social services, energy, farm policy, and public safety. If you dislike the direction Kansas has taken under Brownback's leadership, you will find Johnson's presentation the perfect synopsis as to what needs to change with the next administration and why. This show was recorded on January 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the forum committee. The forum exists. Our mission is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning, we have a really interesting presentation by somebody who knows. Paul has been a lobbyist for almost 40 years. Can you imagine being in Topeka for 40 years? But anyway, he's also, you may not know, an organic farmer, and I have with a farm north of Lawrence, and I have actually eaten some of his produce. So he's also cutting edge. So I think right now is a very important time in Kansas politics, although the Brownback administration, as you know, had his experiment in Kansas had national ramifications. So anyway, without further ado, I'll give it over to Paul.
Well, good morning, all. Thanks for the invitation to come back. I was here a couple years ago talking more specifics about the state budget, and I'm going to cover more political issues before the Kansas legislature, and hopefully what we may see on the election campaign trail this year with all our statewide offices and all the House members being reelected. You know, when Craig invited me, obviously we had assumed that's Governor Brownback, good old Sam, would be on his way on to D.C. at this point. And such as our political world, seems like it's turned upside down. That hasn't happened yet, you know, and we'll see if he ever does get approved at this point. His vote in Senate Foreign Relations Committee was 11-10, so I think he's got a few Republicans he's going to have to convince on the floor to vote for him. You know, in some ways it's really fitting because Sam was first elected governor in 2011, and he pushed his Kansas income tax experiment. And he was very clear to everybody that the last thing he wanted was for a Democrat to vote for his tax bill. And he's run the most partisan political machine that I think we've ever seen in Topeka, and really tremendous divisions. So, and it's kind of amazing as much as he dislikes government at this point. I meant, he's been a public servant his whole life. You know, the Farm Bureau tutored him into as Secretary of Agriculture was his first. He went to Congress from there, on to the U.S. Senate, now to the governorship, and is kind of waiting, I think, for a government-funded retirement plan in Rome. As he fades off the political scene. Well, as Craig said, 2018 marks the 40th year that I've been a legislative advocate. I started as a paralegal working with the Legal Aid Society, and I was working on some consumer and bankruptcy issues, and also I was particularly interested in utilities and energy conservation. And from there, I was hired by a number of churches to work on poverty, lobby on poverty programs. I did that for 25 years. And I worked, also had some opportunity to do some writing on affordable housing and on family farm issues and a lot on energy conservation, something I'm particularly interested in. So these days I register as a card-carrying lobbyist for the Kansas Rural Center, where I work on regional food systems and local, on environmental and state water plans and that. And, you know, when you're a card-carrying lobbyist, you have this little badge they give you that you have to wear around the Capitol, so you're an identifiable special interest that they keep track of at this point. And as Craig said, I've been a full-time market gardener since 1990 and helped start Rolling Prairie Farmers Alliance, CSA, in 1994. There's seven gardeners that work together, and we supply food to about 280 households at Johnson County Community College, one of our distribution sites, and in Topeka and Lawrence. I think before I cover, you know, the revenue and budget and political issues, and the best I can do is cover these in a short order of a list of issues, and then I want to use your questions to see if I can fill out some of the details on it. I should mention the political landscape for 2018. As I said, all of the statewide offices are up, so you've got the governor, the insurance commissioner, secretary of state, and state treasurer, et cetera. You've got four congressional districts this year, and two of them may actually be in play. It's been a while since Kansas has had a Democrat from Congress. And all 125 members of our Kansas House is up in 2018. Now, Kansas has 40 state senators, but we don't stagger the four-year terms for state senators. So 2016 was the last senatorial election thing, and 2020 will be the next. So we don't do 20 every year or every 2 years. You know, thing is, Sam is term limited, so he's gone as governor, and we have a very crowded field running for governor this time. And the other thing I would say is I know that Missouri has very strict term limits at this point, and Kansas really doesn't have term limits, but it's amazing to see the turnover that you see in the number of officials in the legislature. We have 40 senators, we have 125 House members, that's 165, and coming out of the 2016 elections, 56, or close to a third, were turned over. So it's a lot of new blood up there at this point. The other thing I would say is, you know, a lot of people are forecasting that Kobach could very well win a contested Republican primary, and then the question is, does he take over as governor? And my attitude would be that if that would happen, I think Kansas and Missouri would be in a sprint to become like Mississippi. Starved public education, failing social services, faltering infrastructure, and a questionable public safety. The other thing I would say is the one thing that Sam did do in his governorship is when he introduced two-year budgets. So in the 2017 budget year, legislative session, they passed 2 years of budgets. And budgets are really primarily what the legislature does every year. They've got, you know, constitutionally they have to pass a budget. And because that work's pretty much been done, when they come here and they start tomorrow in Topeka, they should have more time to kind of drill down into some of these critical issues, be it foster care, be it Medicaid expansion, be it what's going to happen to our prisons. I mean, there are things that really deserve a lot greater scrutiny, and oftentimes the 90 days that a legislature lasts, they don't seem to get around to it. Right now, Kansas is really in a revenue recovery mode. In 1996, Kansas rebalanced its tax revenue package. So we went to a third income tax, a third property tax, and a third sales tax. And it was somewhat progressive, and it was balanced so that if you had different recessions, the different parts of the tax code would respond in different ways. Well, Sam's idea was that we would just eliminate the income tax and suddenly we would see an economic miracle in Kansas. And sadly to say, the gamble did not work. The new jobs did not come, and the state budget has cratered. The income tax cuts now are costing Kansas about $900 million a year, and that's 15% of our basic state general fund budget. It was a big hit, and that's gone on yearly the last 3 years. And I don't think it's surprising why Sam did this. The Koch brothers funneled their millions through their front organizations, Americans for Prosperity and the Kansas Policy Institute and ALEC and that. They turned the Kansas House hard right in 2012 and finished the job in 2010 and finished the job in 2012, and they turned the state Senate hard right in 2012. So they cut the income taxes by $900 million. $600 million went for income bracket changes and reduced the number of brackets from 3 to 2. So that was $600 million of it. The other $300 million was to completely eliminate paying income tax on non-wage income, what we've come to call in Kansas is the LLC loophole at this point, or subchapter S, or a sole proprietorship. Federally, the federal tax bill that just passed, they call those pass-throughs at this point. Well, when we finally start the numbers of who benefited from this $300 million in non-wage income that wasn't taxed, 85% of that $300 million went to 10% of our wealthiest taxpayers. And the reality is, it was called a small business tax cut, but in the IRS regs and that, there's no definition of small business, nor the number of employees. And the word on the street is the Koch brothers probably had at least 24 LLCs. And in essence, they spent $2 to $3 million to buy a legislature and a governorship. And the legislature, and now they've walked away with tens of millions of dollars annually for the last 4 years. Now, election-wise, in 2016, it brought a turnaround in Kansas to some degree. Many conservative Republicans were beat or didn't run at this point. The Democrats gained seats, and the balance that we've had in Kansas for a long time was reasserted, where you have conservative Republicans, a third moderate Republicans, and a third Democrats. And you work through coalitions there to pass various things. They put together a tax bill to try and reverse some of these income tax cuts, and they had to pass it over the governor's veto. Problem is that they didn't get the $900 million a year, which is what the real income tax cut cost Kansas, is they reinstated about $600 million of it. So we're still struggling with our budgets at this point. There's going to be some revenue debate coming up in the next couple months, you know, because we know that we haven't raised enough at this point. So the question is, you know, they're going to look at various other sources, see if they can find some new money. And one place that people are looking, states are internet sales at this point, and whether they can get around some of the prohibition that the U.S. Supreme Court has put on it at this point. There may be a push to increase property taxes for schools because the Supreme Court says we're not adequately funding our schools at this point, so may be some debate about that. When the school plan was passed in 1996, it was 35 mills statewide to fund schools. At the end of the 1990s, we cut that all the way down to 20 mills. So the question is, you know, for every mill you'd raise, it's about $30 million to help with funding schools if you went that direction. The highway lobby has come in and said that they would like to see some increases in fuel taxes in Kansas. In Topeka, they've been raiding the highway fund. We have sales tax dedicated to the highway fund, and they've been taking that out of the highway fund and using it for other purposes. So the highway lobby wants to reinstate some of the funding base for the highway plan with higher fuel taxes, a nickel or a dime. Kansas, by the way, has the second highest sales tax in the country on groceries. And God, we're only second to Mississippi. My question is, could Kansas put a transaction fee, a sales tax, on the sales of stocks and bonds in Kansas? If we can do it on white bread and you know, food, why can't we do it on stocks and bonds? So we're in a budgetary repair mode at this point. We had 10 rounds of budget cuts. Some of it really had to do with the Great Recession, and at the bottom fell out of the income to Kansas, you know, before Brownback got there. But then he pushed through further budget cuts to pay for his income tax cuts. We've drained any ending balance in our state budget at this point. We've increased bonding for highways and our retirement fund, so we're basically pushing those costs down the road instead of paying for them now. Our state has had 3 credit rating downgrades since Brownback's been in office, and that's costing us more, the money we have borrowed or will bond for. We've cut our state workforce by between 15 and 20% at this point. That's where crippling vital services like prisons and state hospitals and child welfare services. And part of that game is you underfund public services, so that gives you a better rationale to go ahead and privatize things. You know, we're going to privatize and build a private prison at Lansing, or we're going to turn Osawatomie over to a private firm, or now we've done it with child support. And 2017 was the first year that we had a salary increase for state employees in 10 years. Now, they got around it a little bit. The Kansas Corporation Commission, which regulates utilities, has a staff of 300 employees. And 2 years ago, the KCC said to their employees, we'll give you a 7% increase in your salary if you'll do away with your classified status as a state employee and basically go unprotected and at the whim of office managers. The Kansas budget is somewhat solvent in 2019 at this point, but by 2020, if we decide to fully fund our CAPERS contributions, which is to our retirement fund, which we should to shore up the deficit we have there, and if we stop raiding the highway fund, taking that sales tax and using it for other purposes, we're $143 million in the hole for 2020, and for 2021, it balloons to $491 million. And that's no new money for schools, nothing to fix our hospitals or our prisons or our child welfare system at this point. Now, public education, that could be the totality of my whole talk, and I won't get down to that. It's 50% of the Kansas budget, so I'll just give you a couple numbers. In 2009, before the recession really hit, our state support per pupil was $4,400. After the budget cuts and that, we dropped from $4,400 to $3,850. We passed a new school funding package last session, putting $300 million more into our school funding, and that $3,850 gets up to $4,100 after we put the new money, far short of $4,400 and far short of any of inflation that $4,400 would see from 2009. Supreme Court's ruled that it's inequitable and it's inadequately funded at this point. And they've given the legislature a deadline of April 30th to come in with a school plan that is constitutional. What the Supreme Court didn't do this time, they did in 2006, was give a specific number of here's how much more money is needed to make it equitable. I'm going to move on to, and I could talk about higher education. It's down 30% since 2009, and our regents and universities and community colleges all have raised tuition several times to try and deal with the lack of state support at this point. Social services, there's going to be a push to expand Medicaid again in Kansas. They came within 2 votes in the Kansas Senate last year to override the governor's veto of expanding it. It would pick up 100, Our Medicaid program covers about 400,000 people now. It would pick up another 150,000 people. It would come at the best rate from the federal government. The federal government pays 90% of the cost. Kansas would only pay 10% for that expansion. Our regular Medicaid cost is 55% federal, 45% state. So the expansion's cheaper in that way. We've got about 100 hospitals in the state of Kansas, and 30 of them are in pretty serious straits at this point financially, and three or four of them are on death's door at this point. So the other thing Medicaid expansion would really do is help with mental health services coverage in Kansas. So, you know, we've really downsized the amount of money that we put in to our 27 community mental health centers at this point. The other thing I would say is CanCare is completely privatized. It's run by three managed care organizations, and there's a continual debate about what kind of administrative games do these MCOs play to deny certain amounts of services so they can pad their bottom lines, and people are trying to figure that out. The other thing is foster care is high on the thing. We have a record number of kids in foster care at this point. Once again, Kansas was the first state in the country to privatize it in 1996. And this, you know, if you're reading the Kansas City Star, the other, you know, places, we have a record number of kids. We're losing them in the system. We know where some of them are at. Some of them are sleeping in offices. You know, the private contractors of foster care pay their social workers less than the state did. There's high turnover. I mean, it's a bit of a mess. And there's a special child welfare system task force that was created by the legislature that's meeting now, that's going to meet, it's going to provide some debate about where we should go with our foster care system. The other thing we've done is pretty much gutted our basic public assistance programs in Kansas. Most of you know them as, you know, what's known as the temporary assistance for needy families. I mean, it's the most basic support for some of our most troubled mothers and children in our state. When Sam came to office in 2011, we had 40,000 women and children on TANF. Today, we have just under 10,000. It's a 75% cut in participation. Now, that's 18,000 children have lost TANF support in our state in the last 4 years. We've put a 24-month lifetime limit on TANF and on child care in our state. And I guess I look at those 18,000 kids that lost TANF, how many of those are showing up in our foster care system? And could we cross-check Social Security numbers to ask, you know, what benefit are we getting from dropping people off public assistance? The other thing I would say about food insecurity in Kansas, which is kind of appalling in the breadbasket of the world, reports show that one out of six households in our state are food insecure. It's a debate about whether there's enough food at the end of the month for families to survive on. And that's twice the problem for single women with children in our state. We're 45th out of the 50 states and the people who are eligible for food stamps, SNAP, that are actually getting it. And Kansas has been dead last in accessing federal money for summer feeding programs for kids. I'm going to move on to election laws. There's going to be four or five of those that are going to be on the debate. One is to reverse Kobach's effort to force proof of citizenship to be able to register to vote in Kansas. The second is we've got to fix our voter registration system that's connected to our division of vehicles, because that's where a lot of people register, and our computer system there is chaotic. Thirdly, there'll be a bill to establish same-day voter registration in Kansas. You can register on the day you're voting to vote. 12 states in our country have that. We should consider it. Number four would be creating a nonpartisan commission to redraw boundaries for legislative districts and congressional districts. A few states have gone that way. California passed it by initiative, something Kansas should consider. And the last bill that's kind of an anomaly is that in Kansas, our Secretary of State selects the top election officers in our four largest counties. Wyandotte, Johnston, Sedgwick, which is Wichita, and Shawnee, which is Topeka. And it's an anomaly of law that suddenly these counties are raising some hell about it and want to see if they can pull that back from the Secretary of State, because the county pays the budget of the election officer. Secretary of State appoints it. I want to get into three key decisions about utilities that are before us, and it's before the Kansas Corporation Commission, and it really gets into what's happening with the future of energy utilities in our state. The first has to do with the merger of Westar, which is Kansas's largest electric utility, with Kansas City Power and Light. You know, and the Great Plains is the owner of Kansas City Power and Light, but KCP&L. They brought a plan to the Corporation Commission last year, and KCP&L was going to buy out Westar for several billion dollars, and the KCC had real concerns about it and turned it down at that point. So it was too expensive and that there weren't the estimated savings. Well, now there's the second plan on the table where there's just going to be a joint merger between the two companies. And people are looking at it thinking maybe it's one of the unique arrangements they've seen in this country. And so they're going to take all of 2018 really to work that out. My question, and there's no doubt that Westar is going to be sold, and that's a given. The question is who's going to buy it at this point. And my question is, why don't we have the Board of Public Utilities, which serves Kansas City, Kansas, they have 125,000 customers, we have 28 rural electric co-ops, we have three dozen small municipal systems around Kansas, why don't they go in together and turn Westar from an investor-owned utility into a publicly-owned utility and keep the profits that are leaving Kansas for London or New York and keep it reinvested in our state. The great red state to the north, Nebraska, bed of socialism, they have no investor-owned utilities in the state of Nebraska. The second KCC issue, which is pretty vital, is distributed energy. Basically, it gets down to we're slowly starting to see the evolution of solar panels and small wind systems into Kansas. So then the question is, if you've got a solar panel on your house and you don't have a battery or backup and you're still connected to the utility grid and you're using the utility as the backup, what's a fair monthly charge to pay for that? And the other issue that they're looking at closer is when I buy electricity from a utility, you're paying retail rates, and it's probably in the 10 to 14 cents a kilowatt hour range. If I generate extra power and sell it back to the utility wants to pay me wholesale rates, which is in the 3 to 5 cents a range. So I think we need to build time of use into understanding that, and that, especially for solar panels that are generating power at the peak times, which is the most expensive for the utilities, there ought to be a fairer rate. Last thing is on energy conservation and efficiency programs. Kansas has been virtually dead last of the 50 states in having utility-based or government-based energy efficiency programs. Kansas City Power and Light has about $60 million of these programs on the Missouri side in residential and commercial customers. They want to bring that to Kansas, and we're still debating it at this point. You know, the reality is that utilities are natural monopolies. They've got a guaranteed service area. They want, when they go for every rate increase, they expect to get 8 to 10% return to their equity holders. Well, if they're going to get 8 to 10% return in today's interest rates, then I think they ought to offer a full package of energy services, which has to be energy efficiency. It's the cheapest option that we have available. I'm going to turn to natural resources quickly, and Craig may have to get the stick out here. The biggest issue on natural resources is really a water debate in Kansas. And you really divide it between groundwater problems we have in western Kansas and surface water problems that we have in eastern Kansas. On the groundwater side, the reality is that since 1950, Kansas issued just too many dam water permits to pump groundwater. And so in our Ogallala, which is it's a non-rechargeable aquifer, we're mining water out there. It's never going to recharge in anybody of our lifetimes. 40% of the Ogallala is gone today. They estimate by 2050, 70% of it will be gone. The question is, if you define a water right as a property right, and a lot of people do, then we're going to spend tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to buy back these water rights that were issued. The genie got out of the bottle at this point. Of all the water used in the state of Kansas, 80% of it is crop irrigation. And we have no water fees, no gallonage fees on any of that crop irrigation. On the surface water side, and it's eastern Kansas, it really gets down to public water storage and how do we supply water for our urban areas. We store water in 14 federal reservoirs. And the problem is that our reservoirs are decades old and they're silting in. And the storage capacity is dropping by the year. You're talking tens of millions of dollars if you're going to go in and dredge federal reservoirs. We're doing it, we started with one example, and that's the John Redmond Reservoir down in Coffee County. We just floated $20 million in bonds to start dredging that. $10 million for the dredging, and better news is $10 million we're going to use for stream bank stabilization as we move up the Neosho and Cottonwood Wood rivers that feed into John Redmond. John Redmond is the backup cooling lake for the Wolf Creek Nuclear Power Plant. So it's high on people's lists to that. We have a state water plan in Kansas that we started in 1989, and we were supposed to fund it with a third state taxes, a third agricultural fees made on pesticides, fertilizers, and a third on water use fees. Since 2009, and it generated about $25 to $28 million a year for a state water plan. Of course, we spend $5 billion on schools and $3 billion on Medicaid, so I wonder how you put that into perspective for what we're spending on our water needs. But since we haven't put our state taxes into our state water plan since 2009, since the Great Recession, so our $28 million state water plan is now down to $13 million. Now the question is, where are we going to get money to refill our state water plan? If we put a nickel on every 1,000 gallons of crop irrigation water in our state, that would raise $6 million. And but the other thing, a battle that we are going to fight again this year is pesticides and noxious weeds in our state. We're really on the verge of a pretty expanded chemical war at this point. Commercial use of glyphosate, everybody knows it's Roundup, started in 1996, and so for 20 years we've overused and abused glyphosate. So today in Kansas we have 13 super weeds that are resistant to glyphosate. So then the question is, what's the next chemical that you're going to use to control those weeds? And what's starting to happen is they're tank mixing 2,4-D into that. And, and obviously you've read in the papers in Missouri about the problems they're having with Dicamba. There are much greater drift problems with Dicamba and with 2,4-D. And Kansas law has no protection for drift. It has no. If I'm a landowner, I'm an organic farmer, I cannot post my land as a no-spray zone and have any real protection at this point. Well, I'd be glad to talk about, you know, one issue that I think is really going to make the big difference in land use in Kansas for next year. It's going to be at the federal level, and it's going to be what happens with a new farm bill nationally. Kansas has 21 million acres in cropland and 17 million acres in pasture and about 3 million acres in conservation programs. And our farm bill only funds five crops: wheat, corn, soybeans, cotton, and rice. That's how you get to the kind of monoculture, intensive agriculture practices that we have in our country. 50% of our food plates should be fruits and vegetables, and we virtually don't subsidize that a dime with our farm bill spending. And then there's concentration, consolidation, and a lot of other problems. Last thing I'll say with my 30 seconds left is that the debate that we don't have in Kansas that's really needed is one on affordable housing, especially for renter. A third, we have 1.2 million housing units in the state of Kansas. Two-thirds are owner-occupied and a third are rental. And 40% of all our renters are extremely cost-burdened for what they're paying for housing. When you talk about food insecurity or hunger or other problems we have in our state, affordable housing is a key part of it. Bill Graves, in his years as governor, had tremendous focus on housing, and I'm hoping that we'll see that in a governor's race this year and that a new governor will take that on, because we are not going to have economic development, we're not going to repopulate rural counties in Kansas, et cetera, if we don't deal with the housing concerns.
Thank you very much, Paul. Will the ushers please take up the collection in support of the church? We're now going to have some questions and answers, and as you know, the rules are no speeches. You can make speeches afterwards. We're going to go to the library afterwards and have discussion, and you can make a speech there. But here, just ask your question and as briefly as possible so everybody gets a chance. So I'll give it back to Paul then.
So since I retired, I've been an election worker most of the time in Johnson County and watched some of the changes in that. And I was aware of the appointment system, but I guess I haven't wondered what other states do and how they handle differences like between urban and rural and the amount of time that someone has to devote to that process to handle the
I'm not sure I would hold myself out as a tremendous election expert, you know, on some of that. And that was part of the reason why that law went in. Actually, this started in the mid-1940s. I mean, the other 101 counties in Kansas out of the 105, you know, four of them are over 130,000. So the secretary appoints the election commissioner. All the rest of our counties elected it at a county level, or county clerk does it. So, I mean, I just... the other thing that came down quickly is that the... Attorney General a couple months ago issued an opinion about so that this election commissioner appointed by the Secretary of State for, say, Johnson County, that election commissioner has the right to present any budget he or she wants to the county to fund the workings of their office. And the Attorney General basically said that's right, and the county's got to pay fund it. But and I think that's what's driving this debate to get it back to letting the counties make the choice.
I've got a purely political question. About a year and a half ago, I was listening to Steve Kraske's show on KCUR, and they were discussing the fact that Sam Brownback was term limited. And their comment was it didn't matter who got elected governor, he was going to be a one-term governor because he was going to have to attack the tax the funding problem. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, it's tough decision time, you know. There was a lot, it was a gut check time to pass an income tax hike a year ago, and would they have the guts to come back in and raise income taxes again, which is the fairest, most progressive tax at this point. What I would say is I think Kansas is somewhat cyclical, and whereas we haven't elected a U.S. senator, a Democratic U.S. senator since the 1930s, we cycle between Democratic and Republican governors in the state of Kansas, so it seems likely that that we're ready for a change as far as party is concerned. I mean, it's going to be a come-to-Jesus moment when people are going to have to sit down and look at all our revenue choices and options and figure out, you know, we should raise the fuel taxes. We should consider some property tax increases. You know, there should be a broad revenue debate at this point is how do we restabilize it. And this internet sales piece is something that's going to have to be confronted, because as you move more things online, and the other piece of the revenue package I didn't mention that other states are slowly starting to think about is putting a sales tax on certain services like accounting, legal, health care, et cetera. They've run the numbers on that. If we put a 6.5% state sales tax on accounting, engineering, legal, health care, whatever, that brings in $900 million. But few states have ventured into that wicket at this point.
A few years ago, I read an article talking about the incentives that Kansas was offering out-of-state companies to move to Kansas, and they give them tax incentives. And at that time, Kansas, I guess, had spent about $150 million. Missouri, which was the primary target for those programs, had spent about $100 million in defense. So, and the net result was there's less than 500 jobs that had shifted to Kansas. Can you comment about that program?
Well, again, you know, I'm at the edge of some of my technical understanding of all this. You know, when I read, you know, every so often we have a legislative post audit in Kansas that they ask to come in and look at various topics, and they've looked at can we verify the economic development impact of some of these incentives, and it's incredibly questionable. And I think it was in the Star a few months ago that did a series on transparency in the state of Kansas, and Missouri is transparent enough that you at least have a handle on what kind of money they're giving to corporations as incentives, and in Kansas it's proprietary. So how much did Cerner get to go, you know, or how much, you know, what, whatever. So it's a little hard to run through if we really know what these incentives are doing. Or the quality of jobs that we're getting out of it, or it, you know, does it make sense? And I would not be surprised to see that debated in this legislative session on the transparency side, and then move on to, you know, basics of what can we afford.
I have a question regarding comparison. With the thought that is there anything to learn from it? And I was wondering if you have other thoughts on differences between what is being done in Nebraska. You mentioned the public utility issue, but other issues, you know, perhaps debt, et cetera, and that might be instructive.
Well, I mentioned Nebraska only because it was so unique in the sense that it doesn't have any investor-owned electric utilities. It's public power up there. My sense is, and they built a, you know, nuclear power plant like Kansas did and has struggled with that cost, and I don't think Nebraska was on any cutting edge of wind development. You know, I think Kansas went further than that at this point. So, there are examples. I think Kansas has tremendous potential to do more with energy efficiency. We don't have a clue about how many of our homes are properly insulated. You know, the whole technological revolution in lighting and motors and better air conditioners, you know. Our problem, Kansas is a summer peaking, use of electricity. We use far more electricity in the summer than we do in any other part of the year. And the biggest use of that summer electricity is air conditioning. And we don't have a clue what kind of retrofit we could do to replace window air conditioners, more efficient central units, you know. And to me, if we're going to give utilities a natural monopoly and 10% equity, they ought to do that analysis. They're called integrated resource plans, and we basically sit down and really talk about what our energy efficiency opportunities are in Kansas. And every dollar that we spend on insulation or lighting or motors in Kansas and we don't buy unneeded Wyoming coal is a benefit to our whole state. And it's also a benefit in the sense that we could be a much better recruiter of light manufacturing, of businesses, if we had a state-of-the-art energy, you know, efficiency. And it's the same way in some of our housing loan programs. We have a first-time home buyer loan program in Kansas, and we should integrate an energy efficiency component into that. So when a person buys their first home, you've also done an energy audit, and can give them, you know, that benefit of a lower utility bill to help with the mortgage cost. I mean, Kansas has been brain dead on understanding what kind of millions of dollars we could reinvest into our own economy and improve that, as opposed to buying the unnecessary fuel that we are.
Paul, I was wondering, probably all these people here know, and you know, and I just don't. What is the reason that we keep talking about privatizing the schools, privatizing the prisons, privatizing the hospitals? I thought 30 years ago there was legislation passed against monopolies.
Boy, that'd been a 2-hour debate here about, and I've been reading some, I mean, I've been particularly interested in what's gone on with concentration in agriculture and the seed industry and the meat industry, et cetera. And some of this you can lay at the feet of Robert Bork, if people remember that. He wrote a book for the Chicago School of Economics that basically gutted true enforcement of antitrust laws in our country. That his feeling was, we don't care what kind of monopoly status these companies get. You know, if they get too big, then suddenly another competitor will come in and take their place. I don't think it works that way. With four airlines and, you know, we're down to three agribusiness chemical companies and whatever. I mean, I just think it's there's money, you know, if you can privatize public education, what kind of draw would that be for select interests? And look at the private prisons, you know, that Sessions is promoting, they can make a buck, they can feed bad food, they can screw with, you know, the salaries of people who work there. It's an anti, public community feeling that certain conservative forces are bringing to bear, and they've got the extra money and the dark money to push that agenda. And I think public schools in Kansas are in for a battle. So,
in terms of reducing especially the summer energy consumption. Has anyone considered, and what might the feasibility be, of issuing some sort of vouchers or tax credits for planting trees?
Well, that would be another. I mean, that ought to be a part of a systematic understanding view of how we get at these issues. Obviously, planting shade and understanding that is really important. Another real battle that Kansas hasn't been able to deal with is the role of renters, and most renters pay the utility bill, but they don't control the dwelling that they're living in. So how do you get around that? And Midwest Energy, which is out of Hayes, probably the most progressive in going in a rental or owner-occupied unit, doing an energy analysis, what are the best things to change and improve and improve the energy efficiency. And then they tied it to the meter. They froze your utility bill for 5 or 7 years, so you didn't see a reduction in what you're paying for utilities, but you didn't see an increase. And that 25% savings you got from making that energy improvements then paid off that loan. And so when you tie it to the meter, then you don't care if it's renter or owner-occupied. And Westar, our largest thing, so they don't want to be a banker. They don't want to deal with that. The other major player in Kansas, which has been the slowest to respond, is Kansas Gas Service. They serve 70% of the homes heated by natural gas in our state, and they've been dead last to even talk about energy conservation. I mean, Westar and Kansas Gas, I mean, they're turning off the same customers year after year, they're feeding those extra costs back into all of our rates. And we don't have a plan to sit down and talk about, they know which 12, 15, 30,000 homes that are problematic to them year after year. I mean, we just haven't had any leadership. to speak of in Kansas to drive a different agenda.
In lieu of a honorarium, I want to present to you, although I am going to take him out to lunch, at a very fine place across the street at Cafe Sebastian. I want to present to you the UU Forum mug, which you probably already have one, but that's
actually
a different...
The last one you gave me was about a third larger, and I use it every fifth day in my cup rotation, so this will fit right into...
Next week, this is really going to be interesting. We're going to have Lon Swearingen, our very own Lon Swearingen, and you've heard most of his speeches for decades, but nonetheless, he's going to speak on disability rights and civil rights, which he's actually quite an expert, having traveled to Washington many times out there with boots on the ground. So that's next week. So thanks a lot for coming to the forum.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Kansas Politics Without Brownback by Paul Johnson. This program was recorded on Sunday, January 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.